The murdered British holidaymaker abroad attracts newspaper attention, and rightly so. Rare though it may be, we are entitled to know if the natives get unfriendly, whether it be on the Spanish or West African seacoasts, where they have been known to knife tourists who refuse their touted wares, or in the smaller West Indian islands, where motorists have been robbed on country roads in St. Lucia, or for a phase in the 1970s, suffered lethal machete attacks for being white in the American Virgins. We ought to know if it becomes unsafe for girls to go on backpacking and fruit-picking holidays in Australia. All these things have happened. Fortunately, we're a relatively poor country nowadays, and we don't seem to be constantly threatened by the revolting Calabrian bandits' custom of kidnapping wealthy travellers and holding them for ransom. But we may suffer a good deal on holiday in La Belle France. Beautiful she is, and her food and cultural civilization almost beyond compare. Though, like most Brits, I can be even more Italophile than Francophile, given the chance. But it must be admitted that there's a tendency for Frenchmen and Britons to square up at each other as though we wanted to restart the Napoleonic or even the Hundred Years' War. French children, so charming and polite in their own country, are a monstrously ill-bred rabble once they swarm onto the pavements of London. French farmers are happy to assail English lorry drivers and burn their cargoes as a pleasant substitute for inflicting a slow and lingering death on the agriculture ministers and European commissioners who can never tilt the appalling common agricultural policy far enough out of rational kilter to suit the self-interested French paysan. And an English tourist, especially an English woman, wearing lewd clothing, so unlike the traditional nun-like black skirts of a country-dwelling mama, seems to arouse atavistic memories of a need to avenge Joan of Arc in a tiny minority of depraved farmers. Sir Jack Drummond took his family on a camping holiday in Provence in 1952. Pioneering days, those were, for the tent-travelling family. You didn't get the easily erectable multi-room canvas bungalow to take with you. But the long battle with pegs and mallets and guy ropes was fully compensated by the possibility of pitching tent in unspoilt landscape, beside streams or in orchards. A few years later than that, I remember happy days bivouacking with my brother in a field beside the upstream Dart and swimming in that freezing but beautifully clean water where kingfishers occasionally flashed by. Today, the camper is offered piped water and concrete latrines, but has to take them in fixed campsites amid a canvas suburbia. Just one of the many costs of our overpopulating our environment. The Drummonds were not part of a mass invasion of holidaymakers, tenting like an army across La Campagna. They were a solitary family, with their Hillman estate car and a tent. Like my brother and me, they could pull up and settle for the night, wherever they felt was suitable and beautiful, provided the landowner didn't object. For the night of August the 4th, they pulled up near a farmhouse outside the town of Lure. There were just the three of them. Sir Jack, who at 61 was one of Britain's best-known biochemists, his attractive 46-year-old wife, Anne, and their 10-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. On the morning of August the 5th, railwaymen on their way to work found the bodies of Sir Jack and Lady Drummond. They were half undressed, half in their pyjamas. They had been shot at their tent as they prepared for bed. The railwaymen ran into 33-year-old Gustave Dominici from the farm, and he showed them the third body, which he had found at dawn. Little Elizabeth lay in the tall grass a little distance off. Her head had been battered. Dominici told the railwaymen she had been alive when he found her earlier in the morning, but as she was evidently dying, he had done nothing about it.
The Gallic realism, I suppose, which seems so cynical to the sentimental English.
The railwaymen made it their business to notify the police immediately. Dominici was slower. Three dead English didn't mean farm work could be stopped. But in time, he did get round to making his own report. The farm was called La Grande Terre, the big land, and it really was a sprawling property. It was owned by 75-year-old Gaston Dominici, a real old peasant paterfamilias, who was not allowing old age to make him yield a centimetre of land or an ounce of authority to the grown-up married son who worked for him. Old Gaston's wife, Marie, was silent and downtrodden. Young Gustave and his wife, Yvette, and their child were also under orders from Vieux Papa. There was another son, Clovis, and he too farmed. But perhaps wisely, the 49-year-old Clovis had left the paternal hearth and taken a farm of his own in the neighbourhood. Still, they made quite a formidable clan, the Dominicis. Superintendent Edmond Sebaille of the Marseille police was the Maigret who handled this mystery. He questioned everybody in the area, and increasingly was forced back to the conclusion that the Dominicis held the key to its solution. But he couldn't make any headway with the case for 7 weeks. The suspicious peasants just clammed up. Then one of the railwaymen revealed Gustave's comment that Elizabeth had still been alive when Gustave found her, and at last Sebaille could bring some pressure to bear on the Dominicis. So Gustave had admittedly gone stolidly about his business while the child was still alive. Maybe he couldn't have done anything for her. Maybe cows do need to be milked, and feed does have to be put down, regardless of tiresome English children who permit themselves to be assassinated on one's land. But Superintendent Sebaille represented a more civilized France that found this peasant réalisme quite as distasteful as you and I do. He charged Gustave with failing to come to the aid of a dying person, and saw him convicted and sentenced to 2 months' imprisonment at Digne in November. Other, more cynical French juges heard an appeal, however, and they released Gustave. But Sebaille had taken in one clue as he proceeded against the callous Provençal churl. Gustave had been surprisingly quick to say that he had nothing to do with the murders when questioned about Elizabeth. There was no need for him to have said that. It suggested guilt. Sebaille questioned Gustave relentlessly. He was his prime suspect, the last person to see Elizabeth alive by his own admission. So why not the last to see Sir Jack and Lady Drummond too? And at last, under the barrage of hostile accusations which may pass for interrogation, Gustave cracked. "It wasn't him," he shouted. "Il était mon père! It was my father!" Gaston was not present. It's doubtful whether Gustave would have dared to say such a thing under the beady-eyed stare of the ferociously moustached old patriarch with his bristly grey hair. But Clovis was in the interrogation room. Sebaille looked quickly to him for confirmation, and the elder brother nodded silently. Gustave now told the police that he had been awakened by 2 shots at 1 in the morning. He ran out to the fields to see what was going on, and found his father there with an American carbine in his hands. The old man told him that he had seen Lady Drummond undressing, spied on her from bushes nearby, and then came out and demanded that she make love with him. Sir Jack had emerged and berated him, which infuriated the landowner, who promptly shot both campers. When he heard little Elizabeth running away, he chased after her and battered her with the stock of his gun. Gustave claimed that the furious old man terrified him, and fearing that he might be shot next if he crossed his father, he raced back to bed, pulled the sheets over his head, and didn't emerge till 5:30 in the morning. Now it was Farmer Gaston's turn to enjoy concentrated police attention. He was arrested and taken into custody for prolonged examination. You'll often hear crime historians like me wondering whether our adversary system really helps justice. Witnesses don't like being bullied by clever lawyers in court, and many lawyers don't like being instructed by professional villains to accuse the police of lying and fabricating evidence when they feel reasonably certain that the police have done no such thing. But we need to bear in mind that many people on the continent would love to change from their inquisitorial system to ours. For the power of an examining magistrate to hold a suspect interminably while trying to put a case together, which often means extracting a confession, may, they feel, lead to far worse hardship and grosser miscarriages of justice. Gaston Dominici went into custody a resolute and determined man, declaring his innocence and cursing the sons who had shopped him. But held in jail, questioned and re-questioned, he was in the end to make several confessions. In the main, the story was still what it had originally been. He had seen Lady Drummond undressing, had been shocked when Sir Jack came out and accused him of lewdly prying on Anne and making indecent suggestions to her, had shot them while surprised by these accusations. There were tougher moments, however, when he seemed to boast of the whole business, to aver that a free French farmer could ravish and kill whatever he liked that moved on his paternal acres, that English women who came and displayed their bosoms on Gallic agricultural land should be proud and flattered that a native son of the soil found them worthy of being ravished, that English husbands who objected were just so much vermin that a conscientious landowner was duty-bound to put down. But there was one weaker moment. Influenced, perhaps, by Hamlet, the police led the old man back to the scene of the crime and reenacted the murders before him. Years and years ago, Sir Robert Anderson, as Deputy Commissioner for Crime in the Metropolitan Police, used to lament that English cops lacked the powers given les flics. And that's certainly one power our police do not have. You can take a suspect and make him show you, with policemen and women standing in as lay figures, just how he claims to have seen or done what he said or did. But you can't put on a pappy show to try and break him down. This seems to have been what was done to old Dominici. And the results were spectacular. He tried to kill himself by jumping off a railway bridge as he was led away. Now, did any of this prove his guilt or not? It's very difficult to say. We know a great deal about the effects of long questioning nowadays. And in fact, the old man's succession of confessions and retractions, with very varied emotional emphases, seemed to be just what you or I might have uttered if we were completely confused and stressed and frightened by the whole experience. On the other hand, I have no doubt at all that at least one of the men connected with the La Grande Terre farm was responsible. And since Gaston's rage that his sons had accused him was never disguised, I should have expected him to turn the accusations back on them if he had the slightest wisp of proof to offer. It seems he had none. At last, in November 1959, the old reprobate was brought to trial at Digne. The hearing lasted 11 days, at the end of which he was found guilty and sentenced to death. Gaston's response was unequivocal.
Mes fils, quel cochon!
He spat as he heard the sentence delivered. My sons, what pigs! But he did not go to the guillotine. His punishment was commuted to life imprisonment. And in France, as in England, life usually no longer means life. A support group was working on his behalf outside the prison walls, arguing with some reason that it would take a very strong-minded man to maintain his innocence successfully under the endless questioning Gaston had undergone, suggesting with less persuasiveness that the poor old man was senile and hadn't known what he was confessing to. He was released a year later. And crime historians, who like a miscarriage of justice almost as much as a complete mystery, were happy to take up this case. Hyper-scrupulous scrutiny of the evidence could be made to suggest that, while one person had killed Sir Jack and his wife, someone else had gone on to slaughter little Elizabeth. So was Gustave really involved in some way? Had the two sons decided to blame a helpless old man for something about which they had guilty knowledge? All this speculation seems to me very far from the truth. I have little doubt that wicked old Gaston Dominici was quite rightly convicted, but he was released in 1960. And there was nowhere else for him to go but back to La Grande Terre, where one may happily assume that the remaining 5 years he had to live were taken up with misery and recriminations in a family which, innocent or culpable, by now hated him.